Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to another episode of the Cultimatum Podcast, a culture of cults and human trafficking. And my name is Anonymous Andrew. And with me tonight, of course, is my co-host, Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Andrew. Today, we're honored to be joined by T. Brown, a courageous survivor of the Carbondale Sufis cult. And T has made it his mission to share his powerful story and advocate for others who have faced similar experiences. With an impactful presence on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, as well as a dedicated website, he provides a vital platform for awareness, healing, and support. We're excited to hear about his personal experience, insights, and the important work that he's doing in the survivor community. T, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's nice to meet you too.
Yes, welcome to the show.
Yes, we're excited to have you.
Any new cult that we haven't covered yet is always exciting. So where would you like to start?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, I mean, I'll just start the biography, a little bit of the narrative of this whole thing. I've been out almost 5 years, and it corresponds with lockdown, because you may have heard this from other people, but lockdown is what enabled me to have some distance and to start to think and feel. And so I'll give you, I mean, I could talk about this for 7 hours. We have about 50 minutes. So I'll give you sort of a quick biography, and then we can talk details as you are interested, and that fits your podcast. So let me think. I was raised without religion. Really, kind of I guess in my family, my dad was a professor. We were sort of raised, our religion was to be Democrats.
So your religion was political?
I would say, yeah. You know, it's sort of, you know, academic. My mother was sort of second wave feminist. And I mean, I was raised with ideals and values of justice and not religious. And when I was a teenager, I had the experience of being like, oh, I think I'm gay, which I was. But it wasn't that easy. Of course, it was complicated. Then I found myself in college really interested in, I don't really have a good reason for this, or a good answer for why, but I became really interested in theology, religious language, and I became interested in liberation theology, which is sort of a radical-ish interpretation of Christianity, which radically asserts that justice is important. I'm laughing because, of course, that's not really very radical. But the idea that I went to seminary. I actually thought that I was going to be a minister. But the short version of that was that I never really quite found my home in Christianity. I think that I was a little bit more too rebellious and radical. I was sort of an 80s punk rock kid. So I was looking for alternatives and sort of pushing the boundaries. And I was really against kind of theological hierarchies. I'm sounding kind of intellectual, but really I was just abrasively against this idea that there was some God lording it over us. I'm putting my quote, my finger quotes up, of sort of like this, you know, punitive relationship with whatever created us, which is interesting because the story leads me to when I vowed obedience to a guy. And so the way that happened is, I mean, obviously it's a really complicated story. And part of what I'm doing in my life now is trying to unwind and understand how smart people get caught into systems like this, which is something that you're doing every week, right? Is looking at how does this happen? And so for me, the first important thing was definitely my vulnerability, which I was back, I was 29. I was back going, I was getting a PhD in my dad's old apartment. I had a lot of different problems, substance abuse, I had sexual abuse in my childhood. I was rough, like as a 20 something person. I was not on my feet in a steady way, but I was successful in school and different things. And to me, a very significant thing is that this group of people that I met in this little town of Carbondale, for me, one of the things that I've seen in other people's stories is that where I would not have initially have trusted them, I was invited by a friend that I trusted. You'll see, as I'm telling the story, I've done a lot of studying and work, and I've begun to see patterns. So when I say things like that, I mean, wow, I've seen this over and over again in other people's stories. So I trusted a friend from New York. I went to seminary in New York. I made a friend there. A few years later, he was nearby. I was only 4 hours away. He was here in Carbondale, and he said, hey, come visit these Sufis. And I'm like, I don't even know what a Sufi is. I think it's Rumi, right? That's what I know about Sufism. And I think, aren't they Muslims? Like, how does this work? And as a gay person, I remember being like, aren't they homophobic? Like, I projected that a religious group would be homophobic. And he's like, no, I got to tell you. You know, they took in this friend of mine who was dying with AIDS. They have done great work. This is really a legit group of people. The sheikh who's in charge, the guru, is really compassionate. And I just was like, wow, okay, that sounds cool. I mean, I still was – the whole idea of a guru, I was not into that. As I said before, I was not into, like, this hierarchy thing. So what happened over the next, I don't know, year was – a complex but also very typical process of coming to trust this group of people. And that happened through a lot of reasons. There was love bombing. There was also just the attractiveness of who they were. They had an organic farm. They were doing political things, which I was attracted to. The spiritual practices, I think to me, the fact that it was sort of from other parts of the world drew sort of, how do I say this? It attracted the kind of countercultural part of myself. You know, it wasn't a fundamentalist Christian group, which I would have judged. Instead, it was like, oh, this is cool and hippie and weird, you know, kind of wild country-ish, you know, kind of like you've seen in lots of places. I think some people, in the States or in the West are attracted to sort of the romantic ideals and projections we have of traditions from other places. So I was attracted to that. Like, and then there were these cool practices, getting up early in the morning and prayers and chanting. And I found the whole thing mesmerizing. And then I could tell you stories from the first year or so, but there were moments that were kind of choreographed perfectly for me to gain trust in the leader. And he was pretty invisible and pretty hands-off, but the people around him were really smart. They were from all over the world, and they didn't meet my ideas in my brain of what I expected to find. I found, you know, powerful women and, you know, outspoken and kind of political and sort of, I would say, not pro-gay, but gay-friendly sorts of people, like the kind of people who would have been my friends in other places. You know, I didn't run up against some kind of dogmatic, you know, homophobia or anything like that. I didn't find doctrine. I found a place that smelled beautiful, a generosity of spirit, people feeding me, and then sort of a hippie vibe of like, now we're going to sit around on a Thursday night and sing songs and play the guru. Yeah.
Was this something that you felt was natural or organic? Because you just said it wasn't indoctrinated or doctrine. But and I'm just coming again, like we talked before, because I'm not a cult survivor, yeah. But I'm learning, is that cults do the love bombing, like you said. And so they, and then they start the gaslighting and the manipulating and the indoctrination, but they do it slowly and manipulatively. So do you think that was going on the first and second year you were there, or was what you were experiencing very real?
It's both. I mean, I felt really happy to be part of this. I felt like it met my ideals. I felt like there was space. I felt like it was not dogmatic. I mean, these things are really kind of choreographed and curated so that people like me feel like it's not a cult, you know, like it sets itself up in way. Like, so, I mean, there were little dogmas where it was sort of like, well, the guru comes in the room and we all stand up. But I wasn't given a list of rules. I was given a place to stay, and I was given a welcome embrace. And I was early on, I was the guru. We call him Murshid, so I'm going to call him Murshid. That's an Arabic word that means guide or teacher. All right. So okay. Early on, he saw my interest, and he invited me to come on a trip to Germany with them. Bought me a plane ticket, and then there were lots of because there's a German branch of the community that was happening at that point. And there were a lot of moments where I was brought in and embraced. So yeah, it was real. You know, I should say that people have asked me, well, like, didn't you have doubts or didn't it feel strange? Like, no, I was a true believer until March 2020. So for 23 years, I during that first year, maybe about a year after I met them, I did take a public in the community, which was, I don't know, 50 or so people. I took a vow of obedience to the guru, and then I got a new name, which are all pretty not unusual ways that a group will.
Standard practice.
Yeah, standard practice, right.
And I'm just going to interject here that basically what it boils down to for anyone listening that may not be familiar, and Andrew and I have said this many times on the show, but people don't join cults. They weren't saying, we're a cult, you want to join us, mm-hmm. right? They were embracing you, and they weren't calling themselves by that name, and you probably didn't call them by that term when you were there. Not until you leave do you look back and look at it and go, oh my God, this was a cult.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so...
And back then, because I'm probably somewhere around your age, so I was born in the 60s and early 60s, and I grew up, and the hippie movement, Woodstock, the Vietnam War revolts and all that, there was a lot of movement and political movement away from the establishment of the government. Yeah. I think it's safe to say that number one, because of your gender or your gender, the fact that you're gay, that, and you knew that, and we had a guest on just last night who came out and told us she was gay. We all know that the Christians and many churches are not going to accept you. Right. So you found this Muslim organization, who normally shunned the gays, but they did. So you were rolling with the flow.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of atmosphere back then.
Yeah. I mean, it felt open. It felt flexible. It felt loving. I mean, all those things are true. You know,
did they have a compound or a commune? Did they all live together?
There was a house that was a communal house, but there were plenty of people who lived sort of around the town. And then south of town, there was a big farm where a lot of times we were there together. They hosted programs and things, and it's still there. And then over time, in a very sort of Clearwater Scientology sort of way, they have gathered a lot of real estate in town. So back then they didn't, but now there's businesses, there's it's quite a force.
In China. And they're still around today, I'm guessing. Oh, yeah. Okay. And they're global?
No, it's, well, okay. That's a good question. I would say right now, they took a pretty big hit once I went public, because I started to, you know, talk about my experience publicly. I would say right now, the community is, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 people altogether. There used to be and I'll get to this at some point, there was a very strong community of followers of the same guru in Germany. And at one point, 20 years ago, there was an Austin group, a Denver group. So in a way, it felt international, and he would definitely call it international. But right now, it's sort of really just here. And
And I would imagine he has passed on by now.
He's not. He is living and breathing.
No kidding.
Miles from me, yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's in his late 60s. He was raised Jewish from Peoria. I mean, it's quite the story.
I'm just gonna say you're brave, because that takes an amount of bravery if he lives right down the road from you, because I know the fear involved with that too. Yeah, there's a lot of fear involved with coming forward and telling your story, especially when the leader's your neighbor.
They know where I am. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but because we have plenty of time, but I'm just curious. So what year was this? Like you said, you were 29, but about what year
97.
Was this? 97. So you left in 2020.
Uh-huh.
So you stayed with them for 23
years.
Yeah. Faithfully and without question. And then when COVID hit is when you started to critically think. And by the way, you're correct. Many of our cults that we interview, they all started to break apart, like especially the Jehovah's Witnesses. When they couldn't meet in the Kingdom Hall anymore, people started, even with the Zoom, it didn't work. And they all started breaking off and leaving.
They removed themselves from that echo chamber of and that where you keep hearing the same thing and you just keep reassuring yourself that you're doing the right thing. And then when you step out of that and you get other opinions and other input and you start to put things together, it really opens up your eyes. And I'm sure that was, that in itself is traumatic when you realize that.
And we call that, and I'm sure you're familiar with the term critical thinking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can describe that because, oh God, yeah. So for me, the way that I experienced it, one of the cool things that I did, not knowing that I was doing it, was that I picked up my phone and started making videos. So my YouTube channel has 250 little videos of me unwinding this thing that started April 2020. Like, and I picked up my phone and I started talking about, and I remember feeling like, in a cult, your experience doesn't matter. Right? Like, so how I felt, what I thought was unimportant. It was irrelevant. In fact, it was in a way the enemy, right? Like I had to fight it and push it down. So my feeling about, it's not like my critical thinking suddenly started happening. The way I would describe it is that I started to feel my body for the first time. And my first, this was, I'd be interested. I'll bet other people have had the same experience, but like suddenly everything's canceled. I'm in my house. I'm with here's part of the other story. I'm with my wife, which happened in the group. I'm with my daughter and my mother in this house. And if we hadn't had a separate house, I don't think I would have gotten out.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
you just dropped the white elephant.
Yes, I did.
You're gay, but you got married to a woman.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Do you want to go into that or?
Sure, I don't mind.
Okay.
I mean, I want to say, I was going to say I could write a book about this, but I literally am going to write a book about this because.
You should.
I will. I'm getting a PhD. So anyway, that's what I'm doing. This is how I would explain it. And it's kind of perfectly orchestrated because he never told me I can't be gay. No one said to me, you can't be gay. And this is hard to understand, but I think, Melody, you'll understand. But my job was to emulate him. My job was to was to be as much as a devotee as I could possibly do, get. And in this tradition, this Sufi tradition, the way that he showed it to us was that we were to obey him. And our job was to get as close to him as possible because he was the key, the gateway to God. And his spiritual authority was impeccable. You know, did you have a question, Andrew?
Yeah, well, yep. I'm going to assume that, like many cults, they wanted you to procreate so you would have more members. So was that one of the reasons why you got married, was to appease him? And
no, that wasn't really? In this case, it was that he presented reality in a binary, which is what we're seeing in the world now. It's like there's men and there's women. So like, and I was sort of in between, like I didn't quite fit there, but in order to follow the vows that I, in order to be good at this, in order to do this right, which I wanted to do, my job was to emulate him. And at a certain point, I thought, well, I should probably just marry this person. I should probably do this. And actually, I just wrote, one of the things I'm writing about in my studies is about how ritual, and in our case, it was ritual and prayer and chanting, how these practices impact a person, or in this case, my cognition and my feelings and my thoughts. And I had a very specific moment of being in a chanting session and having this woman who lived with me in our house together come into my brain. And what I did is I interpreted that as sort of God's message to me that I should marry her. And so we just decided that was the best thing to do. And now he never told me not to. He never said, no, you shouldn't do that because you're a gay guy. He enabled it, and we had a beautiful wedding. And so again, this is the kind of thing that if I go back and sort of study what happened to my brain and my body, it's quite fascinating and a little bit and terrifying that I was led away from my own desires.
I was just going to ask you that because I'm gay friendly, and I know I have friends, and I know that that's a core, that's who you are. But then all of a sudden you're marrying the opposite gender and having to have, I guess, sexual relations with them, which again goes against your grain. Can I ask you how that played out? You don't have to go into details, but
well, this is what you understand, and again, Melody will understand this. It's we were committed to him. We were married to him. You know, so our primary relationship was with him, not with each other. And that is one of the ways that a cultic or coercive group functions, is by, in a way, disabling people's relationships with themselves and with one another. So, in other words, we just decided this was the right thing to do. We were committed to our life. We just did it. And then, you know, whatever conflict I felt inside, I just had to literally push it away. Push. So Andrew is using an image of pushing. Yeah. So that's how it felt.
You pushed it down. You had to suppress it. Yeah.
You push it down. And then going back to, I'm sorry, go ahead, Melody.
Oh, I was just going to say that. And I've always said that in my marriage, which didn't last after we left the cult either, that when you're in a cult, that you tend to marry what I term as cult versions of each other, meaning you become part of the group, and you're like a robotic version of yourself doing what the cult wants you to do, and so is the other person. So when you leave, you not only don't know who you are, but you don't know if you're even compatible with the person you're with, and you're like and most of the time those marriages don't last because there's so much trauma that you have to sort through. And for you, I mean, you've got a whole nother element in there, that you were a gay man who married a woman because of the cult version of yourself. You told yourself that was the right thing to do in the moment.
I like that. I like the way you said that.
And traditional marriages, I'm just being very, very broad, traditional marriages are a male and a woman, or gay couples. They get to know each other and fall in love with each other because of their personalities, their characteristics, their looks, and yada, yada. But in a cult, like Melody said, you're marrying them because they're like the mirror version of yourself. So, Melody did say that her marriage ended. Your marriage did end?
It ended after 2020, yeah.
Okay.
It ended. it's.
Did
it was.
Did she know you were gay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But we sort of, I don't know, we sort of collectively decided to forget about it.
Yeah.
It was complicated. I mean, it's one of the things you look back on and you go like, wow, what humans are capable of, right? And I do want to tell this story, kind of go back to 2020 March, because the first thing I felt when lockdown happened, which was, I think, the first thing to admit to myself, which was terrifying, as all cult survivors know, was that I felt relieved. So in other words, like all the Jehovah's Witnesses, like everyone who was in a cult when lockdown happened, you know, those of us who got out, like I remember sitting here going like I could take a breath. And then I don't know the timing, but maybe a week later at some point I was like, said to myself, I whispered to myself, you know, because these were such scary thoughts, like, why do I feel relieved? Is it, I'm not supposed to feel relieved. I'm supposed to long for that life to come back to me, because that is the God-given purpose for me. Like, why do I feel relief? Right? Did you have a question?
I have a statement, and yeah. I've never made this statement before, and I don't know how it will be received, but... You know, COVID was horrible. We lost many people. But I wonder if there was a purpose behind that. Because the pandemic ended not just many people who were in cults. Like, all the cults that we've interviewed said that the pandemic is when they left. Majority of them. But it also ended many marriages that were husband and wife were stuck home with each other. They realized all of a sudden they had nothing in common. You know, and so those marriages ended, jobs ended. I'm trying to put a silver lining around the pandemic, and I don't think that's.
I think it is that it forced all of us as people, as a society, to sit with ourselves. It forced us to sit with ourselves
Absolutely.
In silence and ponder our life decisions and say, am I really where I want to be? Am I really doing what I want to do? Am I really in the right place with the right people doing the right things? I think that's what you're getting at, Andrew.
Yeah. So if there was a silver lining around that, even though we lost, I don't know what the number is, but hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people around the world, it had a good outcome. Where, like Melody said, even myself, I was in a relationship and the woman said to me, I cannot see you during, because she was in the medical field. So I'm in lockdown. We can't see each other for like 4 to 6 months. And I had a hissy fit. And I'm like, what? And that forced me, like Melody said, to sit with myself. And I'm glad I did. You know, I did find a lot about me. So we're not talking about me though. So, all right. So pick up wherever you left off.
So the getting out had a lot to do with, it just had to do with me sort of sitting and breathing. And then it gave me a chance to think about some of the stuff that had happened recently. And of course, I don't mean to say of course, but not surprisingly, I looked back on some moments for the first time and said, that wasn't very nice, you know, how I had been treated. And it was very difficult. I sat across from my wife and I said to her, this was maybe the scariest thing I ever said. I said, like, how do you feel about backing off of our community life? And she said, oh my God, yes, please. He was ready.
Yeah.
And
again, the pandemic helped.
Well, she had been ready for years.
Yeah. And this was the perfect opportunity.
Yeah.
We hear this, again, we're 50 episodes in, and I have to say over 2/3 of our stories, people had left their cult during the pandemic, and it's just very common.
Oh, I just was wondering, how long were you married?
Almost 20 years.
Wow. Okay, actually, when we got the majority of your time in the cult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so, and we had, my daughter at the time was 18, so we were, you know, we were all in here, and that's when, and I remember thinking, again, you know, memory is very faulty, but gradually I started to think, like, my wife and my daughter were like, you should go talk to Murshid. And I remember thinking, why? There was always this thing that we were supposed to do that. We were supposed to go talk to him about any major things, right? Like Jehovah's Witnesses are supposed to go through this process with the elders, whatever. But I remember thinking, like, I knew that what I felt and thought would not matter. I mean, I had to admit that to myself, because over 23 years, I watched people leave over and over again, and I never once heard him say that it was good or to in any way validate a person's experience. It was always negative to leave, and it was always going to come with some horrible spiritual consequence.
Of course. Right. Yeah.
So I knew that if I tried to talk to him, that I would just buckle, because I had zero power with that man, you know, and this was, of course, the biggest problem that's really very parallel to domestic violence, is that my relationship to him was 100% him. And that was explicit. He was the conduit to God. So my job was to be wrong about everything. So
when you went to your wife and asked her about leaving the cult.
Yeah.
And you said your daughter was about 18.
Yeah.
Did you have a conversation with her as well?
Well, yeah, they knew. I mean, it was gradual, because I kind of thought, well, why don't we back off of our life? And I sent an email that was sort of very polite. And I said, please take me off the payroll of the, you know, because we didn't know how long things were going to be closed. I always worked for the community businesses, and I said, take me off the payroll. And we sort of snuck in right before full lockdown happened, and I put my keys there, and I sent the email. And then later that day, I started to get phone calls from everybody. And I had a long voicemail from Murshid, and I had all these voicemails and calls. And I decided, because somewhere in myself I knew, to not take any of the calls. I blocked all the numbers, and I deleted all the messages. I didn't listen to a single one, because I knew.
Good for you.
What was coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what came over the next, because I'm a very resourceful person, within a month I had a stack of cult books. And I just read all of them. I read Lifton and Dan Shaw and Alexander Stein and Janja Lalich, and I read them. And that's when I started to go, like, holy shit, this is
a cult.
Why am I feeling like, and then watching the documentaries and realizing this is the same. When The Vow came out, I said, this is the same as my experience. It's not even a little bit different. It's the same.
Well, and Andrew and I talked about this, and I went through that same experience where you're like, oh my God, do all these cult leaders get a playbook and they all just do the same thing to control these? I mean, when you figure that out, your mind is blown. You're just like, whoa. How does this work, and why are people so susceptible to this? Is what you know, what I wanted to know. Like, why are we susceptible to this? Because it's a little scary.
It's very scary. It's terrifying. I mean, again, we don't have time to go through details, but I really look back and I consider that I would call myself an extremist, in the sense of I upheld a dogma. I obeyed a dude no matter what he said. I disregarded my own feelings and thoughts. I did that with an explicit spiritual instruction to deny myself and obey him, because we believed that he was, you know, had a divine legitimate inheritance of a, you know, a legit traditional power, which was given to him. I mean, it was, the whole thing was painted in such a way that I did things that were enormously cruel to myself and to other people. I was definitely inner circle and very intimate.
Were you employed during those 23 years, or did you work strictly for this Sufis?
They own locally a couple of businesses, and I always worked for the businesses. So I was, and again, any cult survivor will recognize this, but I was paid minimum wage, but also I worked 80 hours a week for everything. Like everything I did was with them, for them. And that included, I have a presentation up on YouTube that I gave at a local, it was actually a winery. And I describe in there our weekly schedule. And so now I understand the word labor trafficking. Labor trafficking is where I was volunteered. I mean, I gave them countless hours of labor time that I did not charge them for. And even when I was working for the businesses, you know, I did always over and beyond what I was asked to do, and I didn't charge them for it. I considered it like a family business. Now I look back and I think, God, I gave them hundreds of thousands of dollars, not just my tithing, but like there was a certain point of time where like I made $2,000 and immediately gave $1,000 back in rent and tithing and, you know, and then when I joined them in 1997, 1998, I was in a PhD program to be a psychologist. And I think, wow, I gave that up and instead worked for, you know, $5 an hour for my entire 30s and my entire 40s. So when I got out of that, I'm like, wow, I have no money, and I have a lot of skills, but nothing marketable.
Those are your skills.
Yeah.
And so again, maybe jumping ahead, so you're out 5 years. Are you employed today? And are you, I think you said you're going to school for your PhD.
Yeah, this is exciting. And I think that also, so let me just say that within 6 months, my wife and I both had boyfriends. It's very painful and horrible and also kind of fucking funny, you know?
Yes.
Like in the way that we did that, and we got divorced living together, it was not all easy. It was, a lot of it was very, very difficult. And I mean, just coming out of a cult, but then.
Well, you guys came together and realized that the marriage was a pretense, and it wasn't real. You didn't have physical attraction to each other. You didn't really, like Melody said, you married each other as a mirror image of what you were supposed to be. And so when you left, you found your boy. Are you still with him today?
Yeah.
Great. So you found your soulmate, or whatever you choose to call him. And she found hers.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was an amiable split.
It was amiable. That does not mean it was easy.
I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure your daughter, how did your daughter deal with it?
Well, she went off to college. She went off to have a COVID college experience. So it was very hard, but it was all good. What happened with me is I realized I want to go back and finish this PhD that I quit. Like I quit 27 years ago. I want to go and finish it. But I found this little niche for myself here at the college, which I didn't even know existed. And I found these people in the communication studies department here. And it's very hard to explain, but they do this thing called performance studies. And I've always been a performer. And so I have gotten, over the last 4 years, I just finished my last course and finished my prelims. I have gotten to make music. I have gotten to make video. I have been always encouraged. And these people, they know me, they love me, they support me. I've gotten to explore and write papers about all kinds of culty things. And they've also, as anyone knows who's left a coercive environment, it's very traumatic, and it takes a lot of time to begin to articulate yourself, because
deconstruct.
And it's very, I mean, God, dark depression's filled with rage. You know, it's like, it's just so, it is so full of grief. Because I gave away, I gave him 23
years of
years
your life.
Of my life.
Yeah.
I mean, there is not a switch to flip to make that okay.
No.
Right?
No.
So, and then when I admitted to myself that I was a gay person again, had to come out twice, and then I got with my partner, like there was the joy of finding myself again, but also simultaneously this rage of like realizing at that moment more than ever that he was a con man, and that if there was any religious leader who would lead a person away from themselves in that way is a fraud and does unspeakable violence, you know, like horrible. So what I'm doing, I'll just, again, we don't have that much time, but
we can begin to wrap up, but we still got about 10 minutes. So
all right, well,
tell us what
highlights
today. Yeah.
In 3 months, I am doing this wild performance art piece, which I'm calling cult piece. And I've just, because, you know, telling the story in words, I feel like hasn't gotten to it. So I found these great people in this great little theater. And I put together this like sound video thing, which is full of kind of chaos and kind of difficult, tight reverberations, trying to depict for other people what it's actually like to live in this space, you know, and because we can tell you the stories all day long, but like what I'm trying to do is create an environment that in some way depicts what it's like to be trapped like that. And I have to thank the people who at this department, who I happened to run into, who have enabled me to do this kind of work.
Yeah, right? And to the exact point that we discussed earlier before we started recording, I am not a cult survivor, so I have no idea what it's like to be in a cult. And, you know, while you were speaking about having given 20 years of your life to something that it seems like, and tell me if I'm wrong, that you regret doing that, I'm an alcoholic in recovery. So I gave 15 or more or 20 years, because I had two different relapses, but of 20 years of my life to alcohol. And I feel like I'm angry at the disease. I'm angry at alcohol. I'm angry at myself, yada, yada. And I'm working on that, of course. But I get the idea that a chunk of my life, I will never get back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's grief. It's grief.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. But at some point, there has to be some self-forgiveness.
It comes gradually over time, and there's no way of rushing it or making it easy.
No.
You know?
No.
So are you close to getting your PhD?
I am about to, here in the next month or so, I will be writing the dissertation, which is about, okay, I'm gonna tell you a couple things. This cult is still going on here. And let me just say it's really complicated. And one of the things I learned, and I just want to say this into the microphone, because the more and more I say it, is that one of the things I didn't know in the cult is that he is a sexual groomer, just like most of these other guys. And I didn't know it. So what's happened is, the good thing about me picking up this phone and starting to post videos was that I was the first person in 25 years to do this with this group. And that what that led to is it led to women coming forward and telling their stories. And a lot of people have gotten out because I blabbed my mouth.
Good for you.
And yeah. I didn't set out to be a hero. I just set out to speak.
Yep.
To try to speak words that were true for me. That's all that I did.
And that's all it takes is right. One person in any kind of organization. So it could be a workplace where there's a sexual, where there's a boss who's sexually harassing the women. Mm-hmm. Well, it takes one of them to come forward, and then all the rest come forward. So I applaud you for doing that. And tell us a little bit about your YouTube channel. Is that, you still working on that?
It's pretty infrequent now. It's becoming, you know, more, a little bit more of the, you know, art art and music that I'm doing. But
okay.
But at first, like I said, there are 217, I call it quit your cults. It's one word. And I just started, I mean, it's right now, it's a really, it's a log, a vlog of me slogging through those first few years, you know, like, you know, really live. And I didn't want to make it flashy. I still don't. Like, I'm still sort of resisting these high production values. It's like, I don't want to, I am working on just telling the story, trying to make it accessible to people.
Can I ask a question?
Do you,
now that you're out 5 years and you're posting videos and you have this event coming up, do you put it out there on either social media or anywhere to members of this group who are still in, that if they want to come out, that they can contact you? Or
I am not. I think just to survive, people know where I am, so I don't reach out. But I'm visible, and I know that other people who have escaped have watched my videos, and
okay,
they know that I'm doing this, and if they want to reach out, they can. But no, I'm not. I try as best as possible to make the tone of my social media stuff just, here's my experience, here's my experience, here's okay. my experience. What I want to say is that I am going to get to write this dissertation. And one of the things, I don't know if I want to get into this, but this whole thing that I'm, the field that I'm interested in describing this through this lens is called performance studies. And let me just put it this way. I feel like a lot of books about cults are really important, and they're great, and they've saved me. What I feel like is hard to get at is kind of the words that I use are choreography of how a thing really happens and takes place. So like, I can tell you the story, but like, there's a way that things operate in these groups, and the way that the guru acts, and the way that the women act, and the way that the devotees act. And it's very performative. It feels a certain way. There's a smell. And I think, Melody, I think you understand this. Like, there's a way that a thing feels. And I'm going to try the best that I can in words to start to try to unpack that a little bit. Like, how did these, like, take these scenes and really look at them, you know? That's what I'm going to try to do in my work.
Sounds like you almost are in trying to replicate the emotion and the experience for somebody who hasn't been through it, that could maybe watch it and have an idea of what that might be like, or how you might get involved, and or how you feel when you're in it and when you leave.
And also, I think part of it, just as a part of the healing process, is that all that stuff was so private, and it was such a private hell, that there's something about speaking it or enlivening it. Like, I don't want to necessarily go back, because that can be traumatic, but I want for me and for others to be able to sort of, I don't know, it's like put it on a stage and say, yeah, this is what that was like, because there's something in that is healing for us. Like, yeah, that was, like, there's an acknowledgement. And also, we were so squashed, and now we want to be heard. We want autonomy, and we want.
Yes. I get it totally. See, that's why I'm doing this podcast.
Yeah.
For the exact same reason. This is my stage, you know, for the exact same reasons, to just, because there is something with connecting with other people who have also been through similar experiences that is healing, that, oh, they understand how this happened to me and how I ended up in this, because they've been there. They've done it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm just going to make a statement, and then I'll give you a couple of minutes to wrap up and give some final thoughts. But the common denominator that I keep hearing over and over again, and it started with the Twin Flames universe, is that these gurus or cult leaders or fill in the blank, they prey on the vulnerable. And I think, if I remember the beginning of your story, you met a man. He knew you were gay, and he knew that you'd be welcome, but he was recruiting you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but he would never think of it that way.
No, I mean, of course, no. At the time, right. It wasn't consciously, because he was a devotee to this guru. Yeah. So
he was bringing you into enlightenment.
Yeah, exactly, and to all the other cults, especially some of the new ones that are online today, they prey on the lonely, the vulnerable, the people who they want to have a sense of belonging to something, and they don't. They're sitting at home. And they can't get dates, or they don't have social circle or friends. So look at this online organization that, you know, for $20 a month I can become, you get the idea. All right, so T, take us through where you are today, and where we can find you online, and we'll wrap it up.
We have a group of survivors. We put together a website called Carbondale Sufis, and I think it's really actually really well done. It's not full of information, but what it does is it allows people who want to Google something because they've heard something and they'll find it. That's why we named it that. But generally, I'm just trying to like have a life, you know? I mean, I'm not on some campaign. I offer like this week on social media, like I'm not an on social media fighting kind of guy. Like what I do is when I notice, for example, that if I notice that a group of people are talking about going to the cult-owned restaurant, and you know, maybe a lot of people don't know the stories, so I might say like, hey, you know, I might send a message and say, like, hey, if you're interested in hearing my experience with this group of people, I'm happy to share it with you. But I don't hammer. I'm not making a war. I'm just the guy who
wants
the story
with his life and try to.
Yeah,
I get that because I'm at the point in my life where I look back and I looked at all of the years that I wasted. But yet I have some good years ahead of me and I'd like to enjoy them as a sober man who broke free from this disease. And so I get it. Yeah. And while I'm in the 12-step program and the 12-step program have some people that are out there banging pots and pans going, come to AA. I'm not one of them.
No.
You know, so if I see somebody in need, I will help them. But I live my sober life and I live my life. And so I get it. What I'm trying to say is I identify with what you're trying to do with your life today. You're just trying to move on and catch up to where you were. So last question, when you get your PhD and you do your dissertation and you graduate, will you become a psychiatrist or?
No, I'm going to be, you know, a PhD with no marketable skills.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm hoping that I can write and then I'm hoping that I can make music. I'm hoping that I would love it if I could perform this cult piece around in other places. So I even applied to the ICSA conference to see if I could perform this thing. Cause I think it's an unusual medium for me to like try to, with my body and with audio and video to enact sort of it's performance art. So it's weird, but what I hope to do in my life is just to continue working on my self-expression and to help other people do the same.
Good for you.
And one of the things that I'm practicing, I think most, I don't do mindfulness. All this stuff is triggering to me. Like I can't join a group.
Standing.
But what I practice is leaving stuff in the middle. I like to if I'm uncomfortable, I'm going to leave. If I don't like what you're saying to me, I can block you if I want to. Like I get complete control over my autonomous experience.
Too many people engage, you know? and then that's how fights start, and especially like in the political world. When I hear something that I disagree with, I just turn tail and go bye bye.
So
T, we have to wrap it up. Thank you so much. What a different story and what an interesting perspective. And I wish you the best. I really do.
If you write that book, we'll have you back on and help you promote your book.
Yeah, come back to, like back 6 months from now. If you have, if this performance art that you're doing takes off and you want to promote it and tell us where you come back, let us know.
All right. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yes, you as well.
And I wish you the best.
And once again, we want to thank T so much for coming on the show and sharing his experience. One of the things I loved about his, and I don't know if you've ever watched that, but I love his references to the other cults because you can tell he's done his research on all these
absolutely.
Other cults.
Yep.
He mentioned the Wild Wild Country documentary, which is a documentary on Netflix. I cannot remember the name of the cult, but it's about the Rajesh, I think is the name of the guru. And then he also mentioned the Scientology, how they're buying up all the property in the area, like the Scientologist. But what an articulate, just a pleasant interview. You can tell he's further along in his deconstruction process. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And I felt when he talked about that 23 years of his life that he'll never get back, or I don't think he said it that way. I think I said it that, but
no, I think he did.
I felt that because, and don't want to compare what I went through, what cult people go through, but it's similar, you know, and imagine what he could have done with his life had he not joined this organization,
right?
Because he was in school for his PhD and who knows where he'd be today. And he could have followed his passion too, his romantic passion. He could have, but you know, one thing I didn't ask him, and I probably would not have been appropriate to ask him, but I'm sure he loves his daughter. And so I guess I always look for that silver lining. The silver lining of that is that he got a daughter out of it.
Yes, absolutely.
And not many gay men can say that. So I think
no,
that
that's
was
true. That's true.
Yeah. So.
And I'm going to mention, too, the other thing that I found interesting that I didn't get a chance to say it because it kind of moved forward too fast. He was talking about the labor trafficking. And, you know, that's so common in a lot of these cults where people volunteer. And I say that very loosely, volunteer their time. And I know that, like, there's a member, ex-member of my own cult that used to say that he called it volunteering involuntarily. That was how he described working for the House of Yahweh.
And he went over and he did 80 hours a week, he said, where I think they only needed 40. And so there's that labor trafficking in all cults.
Yes.
They will work you to the bone.
Now, I didn't work usually 40 hours. I didn't work 80. I usually did 40 hours a week, but I got paid $1 an hour when I worked.
Yeah.
I got paid $1 an hour.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, well, you were doing better than me, T. You got minimum wage.
Yeah.
Because they considered it a donation or a blessing. They didn't call it a paycheck, so they didn't have to follow the minimum wage restrictions. But what a great interview. And we're just really excited for him and his finding his passion. And
it was a new cult, which we always, you know, this we've said this many times. There's so many cults out there. We'll never be able to cover them all. But every time we have a new one, it's an eye opener. And it tells us and the audience just how many there really are. And I was shocked to find out that he was still alive and he's still going. Although they said he's down to 60 people now, but and maybe hopefully in maybe a decade or so, he'll. Oh, how do you say this?
Pass away,
and the cult will just go away.
That's always the hope. But and the other thing I'm going to say, Andrew, is that you know we talk about all these different cults, and it is interesting. Here's the thing: we get these new cults in. And we find out the same damn playbook, right?
The same playbook.
It's the same cult with a different name. a different name and a different leader. You could almost just interchange all the names with all the different leaders. It's crazy.
Absolutely.
It's insane.
Yeah. It's insane.
Thank you so much, T, for coming on the show and sharing your experience with us. And thank all of you as well for tuning into Cultimatum. As always, your support is greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics. And I noticed the other day that the group is growing. I think
we're
close to 200 people or something. So
We're over 250, actually.
250.
I think we're around 260 or something. Yeah.
That's good.
Yes. And you can also find us on additional social media platforms as well, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
And as of today's recording, TikTok is back up too. So people, to the audience, you know, we record a lot of episodes 2 or 3 months in advance. So right now, TikTok is alive. We don't know
the
day you hear this. Yeah, we have no idea. If you have a personal experience with cult or human trafficking that you'd like to share, please reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you are an ex-cult member and you are looking for additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
You can also check out me on my other podcast, the Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast, where I talk all about dating in today's modern society. So if you're single or newly divorced or just looking for a fresh perspective on the dating world, come listen to me. If you'd like to help us with the cost of maintaining the podcast, you can show your support through the Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in the show. That's hard to say. In our show notes, there is a link that says Buy Us a Cup of Coffee. And that's simply you click on it and you can donate $5, $10, $15 to the show. And there's also a monthly thing where you can donate monthly. But we'd be just happy with the $5 right now. So because it costs to produce these podcasts and every little bit helps.
Yep. And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.